You are listening to the Holistic Travel Nurse Podcast. I want to thank you for listening. If you're new, it's your first episode you ever listened to, I hope you go explore more of my episodes and go check me out. Give me a review on iTunes if this is something you help. I think we all have someone we know that could use some help in their health. And I don't admit to knowing everything. I just sometimes have a hard time coming out with exactly all the cool things that I have used and tried to take care of my health naturally. So now I'm like purposely writing up what's helped for me and what I would do for a 30-day cleanse. And then I will share it and walk somebody through a program, what things I would eat, what things I would take, and how I'd approach restoring my gut, my liver, and my kidneys, and what we work on first. And I've shared things like that on my podcast before, so you can go scroll through and find episodes on that. And I'm looking forward to having my own wellness spa where I offer all these really cool things. And that one being is one-on-one health coaching. If you've never had it, it's time to look into it. Today, this episode is going to be two things. One, if you've never heard about The Truth About Cancer and The Global Quest. This was done a long time ago, but I'm going to take clips of that. And then this old talk from, I don't even know who this was, but it is just profound about the whole cancer thing and natural ways to treat it. So I think you're going to really, really enjoy this one. Buckle up. Stay tuned. Have an open mind. And if you are not into being open or natural things, then hey, this isn't the podcast for you. And here we start.
Would you object if we had someone from our staff appointed to your board of directors, just to make sure that just to see how our money is being spent, you know? Well, that was really a condition of getting the money. So you know the university said, well, that would be fine. Anybody that you would suggest would be, I'm sure, more than adequate. So they began to load up the boards of directors of these teaching centers with people who literally were on the payroll of the donors. So once that was in place, the curriculum of the universities, the teaching centers, swung completely in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs, and it has remained that way ever since.
Predictably, those schools that had the financing churned out the better doctors. Oh, wait a minute. Or should I say, the more recognized doctors. In return for the financing, the schools were required to continue teaching course material that was exclusively drug-oriented, with no emphasis on natural medicine. By 1925, over 10,000 herbalists were out of business. By 1940, over 1,500 chiropractors would be prosecuted for practicing quackery. The 22 homeopathic medical schools that flourished in the 1900s dwindled down to just two by 1923. By 1950, all the schools teaching homeopathy were closed. In the end, if a physician did not graduate from a Flexner-approved medical school and receive an MD degree, then he or she could not find a job anywhere. This is why today MDs are so heavily biased towards synthetic drug therapy and know little about nutrition, if anything.
Now this whole medical field has been skewed in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs, which can be patented and produce great profits for the producers. And then the next step is that means that anything coming from nature is excluded. Mm-hmm. And that's where we think, some of us think, that most of the promise lies in these very complex substances found in herbs and plants and trees and things like that, seeds. Some of us feel that it was probably meant to be that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you come out of all of this analysis and all of this history with the realization that the medical profession is really like a lapdog of the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And most of the doctors have no idea that that's the case. They don't understand this history.
It's so vitally important for us to understand this history if we're going to answer that question, why is modern medicine so drug intensive? And it's not because patent petrochemical medicine is superior. It's because of monopoly medicine, which was created over 100 years ago.
And the other aspect is also monopoly on treatment. Only pharmaceutical, conventional medicine is the medicine that is officially approved and acclaimed. And people who try to find other solutions are have difficulties when it comes to insurance coverage and other problems. So maintaining monopoly on treatment is also one of the way to protect and grow this business.
And have you noticed that?
All right, on to the next thing. Just buckle up. This is a good one. And this is, I don't know when this is recorded. And it's really hard to find. So this is about Dr. Clark and her program. You're going to like it.
It's wonderful that they will invite people who do not have a long record of successful talking in public and history of cancer control and so on, giving new people a chance to express new ideas. Thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank Jackie, my wife, who has attended this with me and has been a tremendous help in doing the research and writing of this book. And most of all, too, I'd like to dedicate this talk to Dr. Hulda Regeer Clark. If it wasn't for her, well, I'll put it this way. Because of her, I have a brother and a sister who are now alive. And what they have done is use her method of controlling cancer and preventing it as well as curing it. One had breast cancer, which later metastasized to her backbone. They gave her no chance of survival. She sold her house, her car, her auctioned off her furniture. And later, I heard about this. She did the parasite cleanse and the Essiac herbal tea thing. And she's doing just great. And she's now 82. My brother, was diagnosed with prostate cancer when he was 82. We live up in Toronto or in Canada, and we have overloaded facilities. They don't treat people at that age. It's just not economical, I guess. He did the parasite cleanse and the zapping of Hulda Clark program and the SEAC, and he's doing great. He's 87 and he plays ball on the seniors team. And he's the catcher as well. So I got into this industry or business, if you want to call it that, I think by chance. I had my brother died of prostate cancer in 1992. I didn't know anything about Essiac or the herbs, but I did try to help them, and that's how I kind of got involved. But more mainly, I don't want to follow him down that path. No, thank you. It was very, very painful and very, very sad. So that's why I became interested in searching the cause of cancer. I'm like you. I just walked off the street, if you wish. Pair of jeans was the only thing I knew about jeans. I used to wear them, okay? And I didn't believe in herbs. They were the last thing I would consider as being useful for that. I knew nothing about parasites, but I wanted to learn, so I was very fortunate in that I had a lot of help and a lot of free time because I've owned some businesses and invent things for a living. And the businesses kind of look after me. So I've devoted 6 years to researching the cause of cancer, and I put together some novel ideas. Anyone or everyone who has seen them or heard them thinks, hey, this could be it. So let me give a very brief summary. Cancer cells multiply rapidly, but no one tells us why. Defective genes, that doesn't tell us why. What drives genes or cells to multiply rapidly? My research shows there's only one process in the body, and everyone has it, and that is the repair of injury. If you were to cut yourself today, your body would initiate an immediate response to repair that injury, make the adjacent mature cells multiply rapidly, they would heal and knit across, and rapid multiplication would stop. If that became infected before it healed, it wouldn't heal. It would continue to multiply. Now, there is a very close similarity to cancer, because cancer cells multiply rapidly without stopping, and cancer cells follow inflammation and infection. So let's hold that thought in mind then, please, and think that maybe a theory for the cause of cancer could consist of injuries to a membrane growth. So I continue to do research, and I listened to a very important talk by Dr. Cosentini from Germany, who's on the internet under the term fungal bionics. He teaches us that every cancer, every degenerative disease actually, is caused by fungus, and there's many different types of fungus. Fungus or fungi invade cells and take over the cell function. Fungi are the most mature type of anaerobic life form there is, and their genetic structure is roughly about 45% the same as ours. In effect, we can have an infection of fungi that will take over the cell function, take over respiration, reproduction, or repetition, and it doesn't require a defective gene. That's an important point, I think. And Dr. Cosentini also says that every treatment for cancer or that he knows of, all herbal drugs, anything you name, there's one thing in common. Only one, though. And that is they are antifungal or they increase oxidation. They reduce the fungal activity of fungi, or they increase oxidation, which is the same thing. So then, in a minute or two, I'm going to go through 12 observations I've made about cancer. I wanted to produce a theory that would stand up. So I'm using a scientific method where you record as much data, as information as possible, then you make up a theory that would answer or explain the observations, and then apply the observations. Now I've left on the chairs, the seats, a little form which has the summary of 12 observations. I'd like to go through these one by one, and this will be the main part of the process that explains the theory. After that, we'd like to discuss why the defective gene theory is false. And that's a big one, okay? But it is important that we are able to release from our mind that defective genes cause cancer. You can't believe both. If there is a cancer epidemic now with 6 million people a year getting cancer, we must have a defective gene epidemic, and that doesn't make sense. So more and more, there's a logic suggests that cancer is like every other epidemic. It's a microbial epidemic. And let's try to prove that now. If you go on the internet under Nobel Prizes, you'll find the most amazing bit of information. In 1926, a Nobel Prize was awarded to a doctor for initiating cancer in the laboratory. And he didn't just inoculate them with cancer cells. These were healthy mice, and he fed them parasites. When he fed mice parasites, they got cancer. He initiated cancer where it wasn't there. And for this, he got a Nobel Prize. 13 years later, after it was peer-reviewed, and he had proved it many times. So we know now that 80-some years ago, medical doctors knew parasites caused cancer, at least in this case, and it was substantiated. How many of you have ever heard of Dr. Fibiger and this Nobel Prize? Is there anyone here? I have talked to medical doctors. Kurt Donsbach, never heard of it. John Heinemann, never heard of it. We helped educate some people through medical school. We have their textbooks. It's not in there. It's like this never happened. It's off the face of the earth. It's in no place. Except it's on the internet because, in my estimation, the medical association does not control the internet yet. Okay. You are able to find truth on the internet. And you can also find a lot of false material, too. The other thing that's important was that, oh my goodness, I still got 29 minutes remaining. I've been here for a minute already. The other thing I was wanting to get at is there's a lot of suppression of ideas in the medical books that I've studied to find the cause of cancer. They teach that defective genes cause cancer. If you're a medical student and you go to university and the textbooks and the students or the professors teach this, you will believe it, you know. I didn't go to medical university. I'm not a doctor. I haven't been. It doesn't bother me to not believe it, but it still took me about roughly 3 years to give up on this belief. As I did my research, I tried to work into the defective gene theory. It didn't work. So coming now then to Dr. Fibinger, how did the parasites cause cancer? Well, the first thing is he found parasites in a sugar warehouse. Wild mice, he found mice in a sugar warehouse. Wild mice with cancer. He had never seen this before. And we very, very seldom see wild animals with cancer. We see pets that eat our regular whole food with get cancer, but it's not a common thing among wild animals. And in the sugar warehouse, there were cockroaches, and horses would draw in loads of sugar. The horses would excrete, right? And the horses were infected with parasites. They would excrete eggs, and the cockroaches would eat the eggs. Most parasites have several life stages. They go through different life forms. So the eggs would hatch in the cockroaches, and then the mice would eat the cockroaches when they're in the larva stage. Now the larva would enter into the mice, and they would bore their way into the colon or the stomach and cause an injury. Now then, following that, the body would try to protect this injury by building new cells, just like when we cut ourselves. It would repair the injury. This is where we get our fibrous growth from. If you think about it, we know that colon cancer comes with polyps. Other cancers come with benign growths. We have precancerous lesions, cysts, and so on. There's always a fibrous growth somehow or other related to a cancer. And this is a membrane that the body builds. When membrane cells are infected, the body blocks off the infection by building a sac or a membrane wall around it. It contains the infection within this inflamed area. So this allows whatever is inside to continue to mature because the immune system can't get at it. So sooner or later, this precancerous lesion becomes a cancerous lesion, but that happens when the membrane breaks. If someone does a biopsy, cuts through the membrane to see what's inside, he's initiated the current of injury and the repair mechanism. If you do a mammogram and squish it to a breaking point, you've broken the membrane, and the current of injury will cause the cells to multiply. If it's just allowed to continue to explode and grow, it will eventually break out again. So there's many different reasons why it will break. But once it breaks, let's see what happens. The membranes now, the cells, they're membrane cells, but they're not normal membrane cells. They're just there to make a benign growth, to contain the injury. They multiply rapidly. They're infected or they're holding back infection. And the current of injury that causes these cells to multiply rapidly also makes the infections multiply rapidly. The fungus and the bacteria or virus that have caused the growth are able to duplicate and keep track or keep pace with the normal membrane cells. As the cells multiply, they have to divide into two to form two new cells. So the fungus, let's use the word fungus for all of them, the fungi are producing their cell wall material simultaneously, but this is inside the cytoplasm. So when the two new cells separate, some of the cell wall material contains chitin. That's the fungal cell wall material is called chitin, like the skin of a mushroom or the outside of an insect. So this mutates the cell wall, and when it comes now to time for the new cells to knit with the old cells, they are different. They have mutated some more. They don't heal. They're like a skin graft that doesn't take. So they continue to multiply. We hear when we about cancer that cancer cells are something is trapped in high gear multiplying cells. You know what it is? It's the repair of injury process. It's the immune system that is trapped in high gear multiplying cancer cells. That's why the immune system does not attack these cells. It's making them. It doesn't attack any of the cancer cells. Oxygen does, and these other things do, but at this stage, the new stage here, I don't think we can assume that the immune system would make the cell and simultaneously attack it. Okay. How does it sound so far? Plausible? All right, thank you. So let's take this now then to look at 11 more observations to see if this theory fits. Number two is that the cancer cells ferment food nutrients. Normal cells oxidize them. And we can see that this happens because fungi invade the cells, take over the respiration, and they maintain a fermentative cell. They also produce enzymes that stop oxygen from getting into the area. So we can explain then the fermentative nature of cancer cells because they are controlled by a fermentative life form, anaerobic life form. Number three, we do not have cancer of the heart, arteries, or veins. Did you know that? It didn't occur to me until much later, but it's true. Cancer doesn't occur in the heart, arteries, or veins. When cancer cells metastasize in the bloodstream, they should end up in some of the arteries and veins, but they don't. And the reason is that the oxygen levels are too high. And they've proven this, and it's on the internet as well. Up number four, up to 96% of cancer cells have traits common to membrane-type cells. Explain what this means first. Membranes, cells differentiate into different types of cells. We have membrane cells for different organs. They all look a little bit different. And cancer cells look like them. That means that cancer cells start from cells that are fully differentiated. Cancer doesn't start only with embryonic cells. It takes the mature cells that are multiplying rapidly to heal an injury and makes them multiply. So that's, you can explain why up to 96% of cancer cells have a membrane-like appearance. Defective genes can't do that because defective genes should be the same as every cell, more or less. Number five, cancer occurs mainly in organs that store body fluids, such as the colon, breasts, bladder, prostate, lymphatic system, and the lungs store air. And so that's a storage system as well. Why would that be? Well, there's less oxygen. There's room to grow. And it's because parasites eat their way from one part of our body to another by going through the membrane and causing an injury. So we can explain why this amazing statistic that I haven't seen very often, 96% of cancer cells have a membrane appearance. Number six, cancer is a two-step process. First we have our lumps or polyps or benign growths or precancerous lesions. What causes them to multiply rapidly? As I said, it's the current of injury. It's the repair mechanism. And we don't need defective genes to make cells multiply rapidly. We don't need to theorize on oncogenes that cause and control it. We don't need to theorize on suppressor genes that fail to stop it. It's all there. If the thing heals, it stops. If it doesn't heal, it keeps multiplying. 7, the body has one primitive and automatic process, but I just pretty well covered that at the same time. But that's how it gets trapped in high gear, multiplying mutated cells. They just don't heal. 8, cancer cells do not knit well with one another. So here again, they don't knit, they don't heal the injury, they keep multiplying. 9, cancer cells lose normal organ traits and develop primitive life form traits. That is, with each doubling of cells, they've noticed that the cancer cell looks more primitive. Well, if you were a normal cell and infected with fungus, and they were multiplying the same time as you do, and they were producing chitin that fits into your cell wall each time you double, you would look more primitive, wouldn't you? Everything is different because the human cell has a lipid layer. It's called a phosphate lipid. It's very thin, and it's an energy wall. Chitin is a protein. So with each doubling of cells, the human cell would lose some of its natural qualities, its uniqueness, its differentiation, it's called. 10, cancer cells have isolated fat globules, not found in normal cells. It's in the cytoplasm, and it's just a globule of fat that isn't normal. Now, why? Well, fungi do not have any genes to digest fat. They don't have any genes to transport fat to the membrane wall. They don't have any use for fat. So any lipids that are in the cell when the cell is invaded is trapped as useless material in the cancer cell. And it remains there and can be seen as one of the unique characteristics of cancer cells. 11, a variety of pathogens are associated with cancer. We know that viruses cause warts, and we have certain types of cancer with warts. We know that bacteria cause problems. We saw earlier today a list of pathogens. Now, a pathogen is an interesting word. All diseases are classified into two main categories, infectious and non-infectious. The infectious ones are caused by pathogens which enter into the cell and modify the genes or cause problems. Those that cannot be classified as infectious are classified as other, autoimmune or whatever. Now, in my research, I discovered that the word autoimmune means that the body's immune system attacks itself. I always thought it meant more something like we developed autoimmunity. How many have that same problem, okay? Well, no, autoimmune is, in the biochemistry text, has never been verified. It's a theory. We have 80 diseases that are being treated as autoimmune diseases, and the treatment is to attack the immune system, reduce it to stop it from attacking normal cells. The theory has never been proven. And if you consider for a moment that infected cells that start to double and have they mutate the cell wall, then the immune system is attacking early cells that have a cell wall deficiency. A break in the phospholipid layer would cause the immune system to attack it. The other thing then is a variety of parasitic flukes and worms are associated with cancer, and this is the big one. Why did the parasites cause cancer in the first place with Dr. Fibinger? Because the parasites eat their way through membrane walls and cause injury. And there's two major types of parasites. There's the microbial ones, which remain in the cell, the pathogens, and there's the animals that live inside of us. And there are flukes and worms, and there's all kinds of them. And they, too, are infected with virus, fungus, and bacteria. They are reservoirs of infection. When a surgeon says, does an operation, removes a benign growth or a precancerous lesion, says, I think we've got it all, I believe they did. 3 years later, you have cancer again because he didn't get the reservoir. He didn't get the flukes or the roundworms in our body. which are the reservoir, which damage new cells, which cause a new inflammation, and so on. So the return of cancer can be explained very readily by saying that we haven't eliminated the source of the infection, or the person has been reinfected. Now, this is where Dr. Clark's work comes in so well, because infections can be killed with a thing called a zapper. They can be killed with different combinations of herbs. And if you study the ESSIAC formula, it is antifungal and antiparasitic. And ESSIAC has helped numbers, thousands of people to recover from cancer. 5 minutes left, and I still got to do one more thing. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that this theory has never been promulgated anywhere. I didn't read it. I didn't see it anywhere. Except one place. In the sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce, the cause of cancer, he says, is the life force feeding upon itself. That's basically what he meant. It's the current of injury causing cells to multiply rapidly. Now, the second part of this then is to do a quick review of why defective genes can't cause cancer. Just a couple of points. First of all, genes are combinations of four molecules, or two molecules each. There's an AT and a CG. You've all seen the pictures. If I hold this up, I guess you can see it. Yeah, see? You've seen these pictures that look like this. These are the genes. And for some reason or other, there's a universal genetic code. There are only 64 combinations. Can somebody tell me, by looking at this, why there are only 64 combinations? And it's possible. What I'm going to say here is kind of unique, because throughout history, the medicine man and mainstream medicine has kept something secret. They don't disclose all they know. They try to make it a little bit confusing and mysterious so that they can benefit as the doctor, if you wish, or as the caregiver. And if you take and study genes in a science book, they are called pyramids. They are tetrahedrons. They are looking something like that. If you can see that, I guess not. But if you can imagine the pyramids, a set of genes is three tetrahedrons in a row, three gene bases. And if you put them on a piece of tape or string and roll them into a loop, you'll get them packaged real closely. Everything can be described as the genetic structure when you realize that the real structure of a gene is that of a pyramid. And it would take a little while longer than I have now to describe it, but there's a lot of interesting things that result from that. The other thing is that genes do not cause anything to multiply. Genes produce two enzymes, or they produce 20 enzymes, and these are amino acids. Some become structural parts, others become enzymes. Neither of these can cause cancer. If you lost a thought here. If neither of these can cause cancer, yes, this is the idea. If all genes are equal because they're made up of these two bases, how can you have an oncogene that is more superior? How can one gene control other genes when they're all made up of the same identical bases? How can you have a suppressor gene that can stop them from multiplying when it's the current of injury that's been known for history through many years that causes cells to multiply? When you think about it, we are told that cancer cells are developed in our body every day, and that a good immune system breaks them down and kills them. But the immune system, we're also told, the immune system doesn't attack cancer tumors. Why would the immune system attack a cancer tumor, but, pardon me, the single cell, but not the cancer tumor? And again, how could a single cell become a fermentative cell all by itself in an area where everything is highly oxidative? All cancer tumors, in my estimation, begin from a large group of cells which first become reduced in oxygen. So now we can look at our things that cause cancer in two simple categories. Anything that reduces oxidative levels of the cells allows pathogens to take over. Anything that increases fermentative levels of the cells increases the rate that fungi can grow and multiply and invade. So we don't really have to mutate the genes for any particular reason. Everything can be explained by fungi invading the cells, taking over the respiration and the doubling of cells, controlling how fast they multiply, and that's basically cancer looked at from that angle. I've got about a minute left, so I want to mention one thing. I've been helping people with cancer, and I've been chased by the FDA and the HPV. I'm on the internet, under the what I call the SEAC homepage. It's supported by the FDA. I think that we as the people have to get together and do something about this suppression of information and suppression of cancer cures. And in my book, I've three parts to it. One is the cause of cancer, the other is the cure, and the cure is basically everything you heard today. And then there's the cover-up, which you can begin to see from what I've said here. Many years ago, the black man in America...
Okay, that's where we're going to end it. We're going to go back to here. And we're going to scroll forward, and you're going to listen to a little of this. Okay.
Reimbursement for, you know, de facto aspects of, you know, overhead costs, whatever it was. So what happens is if I was a physician and I was in that system, for example, I would prescribe a $100 drug, I'd get $6 back. Now, if I prescribe a $10,000 drug, I get $600 back, right? So
In other realms, that would be called a kickback. But in this realm, since it's legal...
It's reimbursement.
It's a reimbursement.
Right?
Okay.
Okay. The thing is, this is the only field, okay, in oncological care that gets that type of reimbursement.
Oncology is an unbelievably lucrative field of medicine, especially when you're running the business side of it.
Oncology is an incredibly lucrative business. And maybe it's because of this fact that we see stories like the story of Dr. Fareed Fattah in Michigan. He was an oncologist that over the last several years, he was recently convicted of prescribing chemotherapy drugs to patients that didn't need it, many of whom didn't even have cancer, and sadly, many of whom died from the chemotherapy.
You know, when I hear about this guy, you start thinking about Charles Manson, you start thinking about Ted Bundy, you start thinking about Adolf Hitler or Stalin or any of the, you know, many, many people that have hurt large groups of people, you know, mass murderers, rapists, whatever you want to call them, people that are tyrannical. But, you know, this guy in one sense is worse than, say, Adolf Hitler, because at least if you were a victim of Adolf Hitler, you knew when the SS was coming, or you knew when Adolf Hitler was coming, you know, you better run. Or if you're one African tribe attacking another African tribe, when the guys are coming down the road with the, you know, machine guns, you know to run. But, you know, in this case, you're trusting this person with your life. I mean, you're going to him asking for help, and even in cases where people really did have cancer, he was inappropriately continuing to administer chemotherapy to them when they didn't need it, or even worse, or just as bad or worse, giving chemotherapy to people who simply didn't even have cancer. I mean, that's just unbelievable. I mean, it really is mind-boggling that someone can be that evil and that greedy.
He's been sentenced, I believe, to 45 years in prison. But the most disturbing thing about this is not that he was caught and that he has been sentenced to prison. The disturbing thing is that there are hundreds of other cancer doctors out there doing the same thing, and they haven't been caught. And they get away with so much deception, violating medical ethics, lying to patients. Most patients never question their doctors because they think the doctor is the sole authority. Most patients don't even get a second opinion. Most patients believe the explanations, the diagnoses that the cancer doctors give them. Oh, this shadow on this x-ray, that means you have cancer. We have to start now or you're going to die. You know, the fear tactics that these oncologists use are highly unethical and really should be criminal. It is completely unacceptable that oncologists profit from the treatments that are justified by their own diagnosis. It's kind of like taking your car to a greasy mechanic somewhere that's not very honest, and he says, well, yeah, your carburetor needs to be replaced, or your car is going to blow up down the road. But he's just making that up because he wants the business. And if you believe him, then you're going to have to pay all this money for a procedure that your car didn't need. Same thing happens in the cancer industry every day in America.
I agree with Mike Adams. As he just mentioned, we must question our doctors. We cannot place blind faith in them. We must be educated. And that's why we are on this mission with The Truth About Cancer, to educate you on these issues. Why are we addressing chemotherapy at such length? Because you must know the history of chemotherapy. You must be informed about the dangers of chemotherapy if you're going to make an informed decision. Knowledge is power, and people are dying because they don't have this knowledge. It seems to me that the FDA in the United States and the TGA in Australia and other regulatory bodies across the globe should be actually protecting us from chemotherapy drugs and other toxic substances. Burton Goldberg, the voice of alternative medicine, gave us this telling quote.
The agencies that were designed to protect humanity are protecting the industry they're supposed to protect us from.
Well, any drug that is on the market available through prescription that has serious and widespread adverse effects, as they say, was previously declared safe and effective by the FDA. That's the only reason that drug reached the market. So if after approval it suddenly has opposite effects, very dangerous, that's fraud. Fraud at the level of the FDA for not investigating the drug properly or concealing the truth.
And the FDA, on its own website, openly admits that 100,000 plus people die each and every year from properly prescribed prescription drugs. What does this mean, the term properly prescribed prescription drugs? This means, according to John Rappaport, these are drugs that were previously declared to be safe and effective. But what does it mean to be declared safe and effective? What is the drug approval process that would declare a drug safe and effective?
The real interesting thing, Ty, is that what they do is drug companies pour literally $1 billion into the research needed to get FDA drug approval. So that starts with finding lead compounds to produce a synthetic chemical that then they go through phase 1, 2, 3 human trials with. But when they do this, they pour inadvertently $1 billion or more, all of these drug companies, into looking at turmeric, resveratrol, green tea, and literally thousands of compounds, and they find all this research showing it's superior to chemotherapy. And so those studies are there, and people don't know about them, but they also can't expect those studies on things you grow in your backyard that cure cancer to receive $1 billion of capital, because the whole game is based on producing a synthetic analog to get a patent, to get FDA drug approval. And then, of course, more than 50% of FDA-approved drugs before the patent life expires get pulled off the market because of the devastation and death that they cause. So the whole system is rigged.
I would have to agree with Sayer G. The system is rigged. But oftentimes, so are the articles that would validate the safety and efficacy of a particular drug. Let's listen to Dr. Russell Blaylock as he describes the way that even doctors are duped with ghostwritten articles.
What happens sometimes, and in fact it's happening more often than we would like, and it's a lot of stuff being written by the people that look into medical journal articles. But these pharmaceutical companies will have written for them ghost articles, they call them. And what they'll do, they'll get this company that writes articles that looks just like beautiful medical articles. It's all the graphs and charts and numbers and references. And they'll write this article without any authors for the study because they wrote it. And then they'll go to an oncologist that's very well known and they say, wouldn't you like to put your name on this article? And if you do, it's going to be in a very prestigious journal, New England Journal of Medicine or some oncology journal that's very prestigious. And so a lot of these people attempted because this puts their name even further out front. So they say, yeah, put my name on there. And so they'll put a string of names on the article who had nothing to do with writing it, had nothing to do with the study. And they'll end up in a very prestigious journal. Well, these journals they choose are the ones that affect how doctors behave, how they treat patients. So they'll read this article, not knowing it's a ghost article. And they said, gee, they've got tremendous responses and there's hardly any complications. And so they'll order the drug and they'll tell the patient the same thing they got out of that article. There's hardly any complications. Patients are doing very well. And there's a good chance that this could cure you.
And it's not an independent article.
It's not an independent article, and the doctor's been tricked, and the patients have been tricked.
Recently, it was a big scandal, but nobody really paid attention that the FDA approved, about 4 years ago, approved an antibiotic, because the data was submitted by a French company, but it turned out the study was never done.
Falsified completely.
Yeah, it wasn't even done.
Now, this next physician asked that we not show his face, but listen to what he has to say about the way that money has corrupted the drug approval process.
Has actually grown to become a percent of one of the most successful clinical trials companies in the country. They pick me for medical. It sounds like the firm, they pick you if they help you through, and then you're supposed to join them. And that's what you're supposed to do. So, like, great, I only get the big, like, join the firm, get the big car, get this. And then you start realizing once you start looking at data and how we're manipulating data and this and that, and there's people behind these drugs. You know, and it's like, but that's the standard now, right? So I can get any drug passed. I can get any study manipulated. It's a pay-to-play game. We sat in rooms where we had CEOs of the top companies come in and say, this is what it is. FDA would say something like, it doesn't work. And then within an hour, we can have a phone call with like six different universities and statisticians, $30,000 each person to work on 2 hours of crunching numbers, flip the numbers, have three editorial reviews, and then in 3 months, perception of that has changed. It's the greatest and best miracle drug ever, although the data never sort of support it, but they make billions of dollars, and as long as we put a black box warning, everybody makes money. Most people think that, you know, our and the physicians are no fault of their own. A lot of them are just doing what they're told, you know, but then, you know, we go back in history where we heard that I'm just doing it now, it's following orders. That's not a good way to do it.
But falsifying research and producing toxic prescription drugs, that's only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Big Pharma. Let's have a listen to Dr. Matthias Rath as he describes the way that three Big Pharma companies, Bayer, Hetch, and BASF, they were responsible directly for creating concentration camps of Birkenau and Auschwitz.
We were in Auschwitz because we have a friendship with some of the survivors that are still alive from that time. And it is, since you asked me this question, I may just spend a moment on something that is very little known about Auschwitz. We've been told in the history book it was a camp that was built to annihilate Jewish people and Slavic people and people that the Nazis didn't like in the conquered countries. But what made Auschwitz the mega death extermination camp was actually the decision by Bayer, Hoechst, and BASF to build the largest industrial plant of wartime in Europe. It is called IG Auschwitz, a 100% subsidiary of Bayer, Hoechst, and BASF. And the plant was 8 kilometers long, about 5 miles long, and 2 miles wide. So it's a giant industrial area. And the Birkenau concentration camp, the huge camp that was featured in Schindler's List in that movie, was a deliberate decision to supply slave labor for the construction of this industrial plant. So, without the interest that we just touched upon, that put profits over lives, Auschwitz would never have had this meaning. The decision of Wannsee, which was the decision by the Nazis to exterminate the Jewish people, was taken roughly 1 year after the decision of IG Farben to build this plant. So the Nazis used the death apparatus that was already existing because of the slave labor camp being in existence. The chimneys were burning. IG Farben was not taking care of the sick people. After 3 months on average, the people were emacerated. And so they were just put to the gas chamber and shut up in the chimney. So I used a few more sentences in the novel to exemplify. If we are talking today that there is an industry among humanity that sacrifice millions of lives or puts them at risk for profit. We are sometimes, you included, being attacked as being out of this world, conspiracy people. Now, we turn around, we look at Auschwitz, we look at the industrial plant, we look at the concentration extermination plant being built, initially built, to serve as slave labor camp for that purpose. And we can say, they've done it before.
I'm literally speechless. Millions of Jews were annihilated during World War II, and those concentration camps were built by Big Pharma to provide slave labor. As Dr. Rath said, they've done it before, they'll do it again. We must understand that people's lives, once again, are being sacrificed for the almighty dollar. Did you learn this?
Okay, I had to just tie it in with that. If you've never listened to The Truth About Cancer and A Global Quest for Cure, you can go explore them. They've been deplatformed on YouTube. So Rumble's where you're going to find them. The other one that was Hoda Clark's program, that is on Rumble, but super hard to find. Rumble isn't easy. It was a platform for searching at times too. So you have that with it. But I thought I need to tie all this in together. this, because when I listened to that one, a friend sent it to me and I was like, huh. I read like 3 to 5 books on cancer. And I know in my heart what I'd do if I had that diagnosis. And it wouldn't be anything in pharmaceutical, not one thing. I would never see an oncologist, period. of course, that's, I guess, who would diagnose. I don't know. So these are my personal viewpoints. I find them interesting and intriguing. And I think that you got to choose your own destiny and your own health. And your own healthcare practitioner. And this day and age, with so much out there, you need, and so much censorship, you need to be working with somebody who has your back. And that's what I do as an advocate, as a health coach. I have your back in mind. And if you, in your choices and what you want to do with your health. So I look forward to chatting with you. You can reach out to me on email is the best way. I do not give out my cell phone number or anything else. And thanks for listening, and God bless.